You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 18th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. From a feast of fine food journals to periodicals prepared to put quality of life at the top of the agenda, we're talking about better living, working and designing here on this week's edition of The Stack. This week on The Stack, we're talking about quality of life in the week of Monocle's inaugural conference on that very theme, which is being hosted in Lisbon, where panels of key thinkers, entrepreneurs, mayors and designers, and of course Monocle's editors, will be discussing how to live, work and design better. Today, to discuss better living through the prism of the printed page, we welcome legendary Australian food stylist, author and magazine editor Donna Hay, and also Richard Spencer Powell, Monocle's creative director, who'll tell us more about Monocle's yearly Quality of Life editions. Also coming up, we'll hear from Terry Selwood from Cottage Life, a widely admired Canadian publication exploring the life-enhancing quality of cottage and countryside dwelling.
You can go camping or you can go to other cities for people who like the urban life. For people who want to go back to nature and they want to, you know, swim in clean water and they want to, you know, go for a boat ride or a kayak ride, canoe ride, it's a long tradition in Canada. People want a place on the water to enjoy the outdoors.
That and plenty more print delights besides on this edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. This week we're looking at quality of life in the print world to coincide with Monocle's first Quality of Life conference hosted in Lisbon. Who better to discuss this with us than Richard Spencer Powell, Monocle's creative director, who can tell us a little bit more about how the concept of good quality of life shaped the Monocle vision from its inception through to the present day with its annual survey exploring the world's most livable cities. Rich, thanks very much for joining us here on The Stack. Great to speak with you as ever.
A lot of people who are familiar with Monocle 24 and certainly with the magazine will understand that quality of life is something that we're quite preoccupied with at Midori House. As a concept, I guess it's crystallised somewhat as the magazine's developed, but going right back to its beginning, to the inception of the magazine, how much was that part of the, I guess, the sort of founding principles, a bit of the ethos that went into the magazine at its beginnings?
I think the kind of founding ethos of Monocle was to do something better and to do something different and to report on an unreported world that was actually better than most media outlets were reporting on. We wanted to show undiscovered stories and positive stories that you just wouldn't find anywhere else. And all of that actually ties into quality of life. And if you look at the A, B, C, D, E of Monocle, you know, if you look at affairs and sort of stories about urbanism, that is about quality of life. And business was always about entrepreneurship, which is about taking control and making your working life better. I think quality of life is about having a good work-life balance. Culture, of course, can, you know, enrich in our lives. Design, by its very meaning, I think, is a life-improving thing. Good design should make your life better. And there with edits, with travel, it's about, you know, thirst for knowledge. It's about seeing the world, getting some sun, eating nice food, which, of course, is, you know, the earmarks of what most people think about when they think of quality of life. So I think it was something that was sort of a little bit under the surface. And it wasn't until we got kind of halfway through our first year that we wanted to celebrate it. And even then, I don't think we kind of knew how important it was. It was more about the best city to live in. And that's when we started looking at metrics and, you know, the facts and figures of quality of life. But of course, as the brand evolved and as we've got, you know, bigger and better, it's become very much important to us. And hence, we're going to go and do a conference about it in Lisbon. And hence that issue, the double July-August issue every year, is kind of a big seller. It's the one that we've sort of put our heart on our sleeves. I think it's probably, it encapsulates everything we do and outside of the office as well. I think what we put into that issue is how we like to live beyond the four walls of Midori House.
Well, yeah, let me ask you about that then, because you sort of alluded to it there and you talked about work-life balance. You talked about things that are close to your heart, like, you know, great design, being about making people's lives better. I guess in your work more broadly, how aware are you of that? Do you think that sometimes there are, you know, creatives or designers who get too caught up in theory or in detail and forget about, you know, it's supposed to be an improving thing. It's supposed to be something that makes life better or easier, whether this goes from how to, you know, signpost a city to how to design a great magazine. Do you think sometimes people lose a bit of track of what's really important when it comes to great design?
I think so. I also think design is a bit of a young person's game. It's popular with young people. I think, you know, media studies is one of the biggest courses in this country. And unfortunately, many things nice about youth, but I think one thing is that it can be caught up in trend, and design is guilty of that. And I think trend is a bad thing, can be a bad thing, because it can distract, and design shouldn't be distracting. You know, you should be focused and know what you want to get out of the end of it. And if you come to the end of the process of designing anything and you think, that looks great, I'm really satisfied because it looked how I wanted it to look at the start, you've probably just followed your trend and not actually thought about whether this object, this product really, really works. And I think, you know, our design philosophy is to kind of keep things simple and keep things reduced and just make sure that the quality is there for the end user, the readership. And that's what I do day to day. That's in about the legibility. It's about tactile paper. It's about making sure that the print is the highest quality we can. And I think that's what people need to do. And not to be on a downer about design, but it's a great shame when you see something like an aircraft livery redesign and you look at it and you think, that's a bit disappointing, and that's going to be there for 20 years, because to do that, those jobs come up so rarely. Same with a bit of airport signage or, you know, a new car, anything that comes out and it's a bit of a disappointment. You think it's a shame, because these opportunities are few and far between. So I think we need to be very careful when we design things to make sure they're long lasting. And that, you know, design to me is about decision making. It's millions of decisions that you have to make all the time. And if you get them wrong, you know, the effects can be a bit damaging.
It can be devastating. We've got some quality of life editions of Monocle, but you've got a whole stack of other magazines here, which I think talk to maybe issues surrounding quality of life. And maybe we can kind of have a browse through some of these. And I guess this is as much about magazines that depict healthy, happy lifestyles as also speak to that sort of design ethos that you're talking about. I mean, some of the ones you've got here, how do you feel they reflect on this sort of area of magazine publishing?
Well, I've bought four issues in, and there's no surprise here, they're Japanese magazines. And I thought I could talk to you a little bit about, in general, about Japanese magazines and their ethos. And what I think is incredible about a Japanese magazine, in the way that only Japanese magazines can do, is they can take a subject like camping, like whittling things out of wood, like caring for your carpet, you know, the sort of things that are dreary and most people in this country think of, oh, camping, God, you know, that's just a wet weekend in Bognor.
Nothing wrong with that, Ritz, come on.
Well, it's their own, but they can somehow turn it into this very aspirational, charming, not off-putting lifestyle, quality of life thing. And they seem to be able to do it, apply it to anything, whether it's to owning a camper van, climbing up mountains, growing your own organic vegetables. There's something about Japanese publishing and the Japanese in general that they seem to be able to put quality of life into any element of life.
Do you think that's because of a sort of an enjoyment and a belief in the importance of detail? You talked about, you know, this multitudinous decision-making process that goes into making a single good decision. Is that a cultural belief in detail mattering? And if you take such satisfaction in getting detail right, then you can find quality of life, you can find joy in it, something as what may seem mundane, like cleaning a carpet.
I think there's something about the Japanese in that they like to do things properly, from laying a table to running a multinational organization. They don't do things half-assed, you know, pardon the French. But, you know, if you look at a small example of, I don't know, gift wrapping in a Japanese store, they are prepared to take their time to do the job properly, to apply the ribbon correctly, to tie it, to sticker it, and to do it to perfection every single time. And we in this country probably wouldn't do that.
We'd
try and find a shortcut. And I think that sense of doing something properly, you know, that just helps with everything they do. And I think they're slightly obsessive about kit and, you know, and getting things rightly organised, which I think is a nice pursuit to have. But there's this other thing, you know, slightly return to Japan, is that years ago when I had a Japanese client, I learned about this thing, Minge. The theory of that is that if you get a £25,000 Cartier watch or set of jewellery, that should be, in the West, that's deemed as the best design thing because it's the most expensive. But in Japan, the best design thing should be a teaspoon or a door handle. The thing that you use every single day should be the best. That should have the most value. And I think that's a lovely ethos to have.
Rich, just to sort of wrap things up then, we've talked a little bit about the detail of magazines and your approach to creative directorship, if you will. At the beginning, you mentioned this idea of work-life balance. And I just wondered, in a more sort of personal sense, when you talk about quality of life, obviously we have our metrics in Monocle magazine, which can be quite specific, they're quite statistical. We use it almost as a bit of a shorthand now, but does it mean something else as well to you in terms of how the personal decisions that you make and how your work-life balance shapes up? I mean, what does quality of life mean beyond, yeah, city livability and, you know, the delights of urban signage? What's a more personal take, I guess, as a final thought?
I think when I look at the metrics listing and when we do our 25 livable cities index, I often don't agree with the final outcome of the list. London often doesn't make it on there. And I think about quality of life, and I think we've just talked about inspiration. And to me, density is quite important. Probably people would think it's an unusual thing to say, but to me, life's about the 6 inches in front of your face. You know, it's what you see on your journey to work. And I think life does need a bit of grit. And that doesn't mean crime, but it means there needs to be variety. It cannot be a serene, anodyne, sanitized world. It needs to have scruffy buildings and pristine buildings and history, and it has to have some degree of interest. Otherwise, for me as a designer, it's just too sleepy. I don't see myself ever leaving London because I think I need that noise, you know, that vibration in my grill. But I think in terms of a more personal sort of life-work balance, I think it's important to have, it's a bit of a naff thing to say, but little havens, little sanctuaries. And I don't care if that is, you know, that you come home and you've got a small terrace and you have a glass of wine, but, you know, you've planted little plants yourself and it's that little half an hour of something, or whether that's a nice collection of books and a comfy armchair. But I think it's important to have those little things set up because it's great to have a good career and good work, but you do need to have a good job, however much you enjoy it. I think it becomes uncreative if that's all you do all the time. So I think it's important to, once you get out of work, to kind of get yourself out of that work mode and to find a decent way to relax. And for some, that's sitting in a canvas tent in the rain. For others, it's a glass of wine on the terrace.
I think we can decide which camp to forgive the pun that you sit in there, Rich. That's Richard Spence-Powell, Monocle's creative director. Rich, thanks for being on The Stack. You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards, and we'll be back with an exploration of the quality of life enhancing properties of cottage life in Canada right after this.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, at half an hour is now shorter, sweeter, new and improved. Where else can you end up informed and entertained after half an hour? By watching a quarter of Oscar-winning The Theory of Everything, by reading the first 20 pages of Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel, by speed-walking through a thousandth of the Venice Biennale, not on your Nelly. Culture with Robert Bound, smaller and even more perfectly formed.
This is what people do for a living, right? They put their shows on. This is the show of shows.
Culture premieres at 1900 hours London time on Mondays.
This is The Stack on Monocle 24. We're heading to Toronto now. Time to discuss an iconic Canadian magazine that talks about something so dear to Canadians, nature and cottages. This way of dwelling is intrinsically connected to Canada's quality of life too. Over the past 27 years, Cottage Life has become one of the country's most recognisable magazine brands, thanks not just to award-winning editorial, but to successful forays into television and an annual spring consumer show that attracts more than 500 exhibitors. Monocle's Toronto correspondent Chris Frey opened up the latest instalment of Cottage Life and spoke to the company's president, Terry Selwood. Chris began by asking Selwood to explain the brand's special appeal to Canadians.
The magazine was launched into a vacuum as far as reader interest was concerned. There was nothing else out there that was satisfying the needs of people who had cottages. And in fact, the owner had bought a cottage in the mid-80s, and he didn't know anything about cottaging. And so he decided that the world needed a magazine. He'd come from Harold Smith magazine and Equinox, and he had been in the magazine business a long time. And when he left those enterprises, he decided that he didn't really know what to do, but he had a cottage and he needed information. So he decided to launch the magazine. And it's been amazingly successful ever since.
perhaps he could explain for our listeners like the cottaging phenomena, I guess. We're in Toronto and Ontario and Canada. It is a very particular thing in this part of the country, isn't it, cottaging?
In Canada, there are different terms for what we do. Recreational properties is the broad term, and people have been doing this for a long time. They want to get away, and you know, you can go camping or you can go to other cities for people who like the urban life. For people who want to go back to nature and they want to, you know, swim in clean water and they want to, you know, go for a boat ride or a kayak ride, canoe ride. It's a long tradition in Canada. Basically, it's centered around the water as far as we understand the term, so that people want a place on the water to enjoy the outdoors.
And as a brand, it quickly grew into many other things. A trade show, which we're at now, or a consumer show, TV. Tell us a little bit about the development of that brand and how it's been able to build such a strong relationship with its audience.
The consumer show was probably one of the first add-ons or strengthening of the brand into a market. And that started where we're at now. This consumer show is probably, well, we think it's the best three-day consumer show in Canada. It may be one of the best in the world as far as consumer shows go, just because of the way people approach it and they love it. And again, it's unique. But it started because there were a few other cottage shows, and they were run by show people who didn't really understand the market. They didn't understand cottaging. They were just out to make money on doing shows. And so the owner at that time, Al Zikovitz, said, you know, this is crazy. We're going to these shows. They're really bad shows. We can do better. I want people to feel like they're walking into the pages of the magazine when they come to a show. And so there's an awful lot of care and feeding that goes into the background of the show, the way the environment is treated here, that we do a lot of landscaping that other shows don't do. We ask that our exhibitors step up because we step up. And, you know, we build a timber frame cottage or a timber frame for our booth, and we go beyond. And so the decor at this show is unique, and people have been coming here for the last 22 years.
Give us a sense of how big this show actually is. It takes up three large auditoriums in a convention center.
Yeah, exactly. It's approaching 300,000 square feet, and 35 to 36,000 people come out. And that's paid attendance. Unlike other shows, we don't inflate our attendance figures. These are real numbers. And it's jammed. If you come here on a Saturday afternoon, you can barely walk down the aisles. It's so busy.
Canadian magazines and newspapers have had a challenging few years adapting to the new media environment. But certainly, Cottage Life is one of the strongest, most prominent, and maybe most profitable magazine brands in the country. What lessons could other magazines and magazine brands take from Cottage Life?
I think the idea is that it's market focused. That Cottage Life was one of the earliest magazines in Canada, certainly, to look at their operation not as being in the magazine business, but being in the cottage business and serving cottagers, and how in different ways that they could serve the needs of those cottagers. So the show grew out of it, the TV show grew out of it, the website grew out of that. Cottagers are looking for information, they're looking for contacts, they're looking for entertainment, they're looking for stories about other cottagers, and they're looking for ideas on what to do with their cottage. And even something as crucial as handing down the cottage, that we're a leader in that kind of information, because it's very important. People will hold on to their cottage. Houses now are, you know, pretty much commodities in the way that they weren't before. It's an investment. And you will sell the house long before you'll sell the cottage in most cases, because of all the memories that go with that. So we see ourselves as being custodians or stewards of this brand and what it means to people.
That was Cottage Life's Terry Selwood in conversation with Monocle's Toronto correspondent Chris Frey for The Stack. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Continuing with our quality of life theme now, we're going to hear from the doyen of Australian food style and publishing, Donna Hay. Donna's here to talk about how her print publications fit into her media empire, and maybe talk to us about quality of life and why her quality of life at home means she'll never leave Sydney. Donna, it's great to have you back with us at Midori House. It's good to start off, first of all, just with sort of what's new. We've got some beautiful magazines, which I'll just sort of leaf through here on the stack. We've got some special issues. We've got collector's editions. I guess, yeah, just sort of bring us up to speed. What's new in terms of sort of, you know, magazine land? What do we find in your world at the moment?
Well, we hit the 80th issue in Donahue magazine land, which is kind of good and bad. It made me feel slightly old, 80 issues, but it was a good time to, I don't know, when you get a landmark like that in your career, it also gives you a bit of reflection time as well, makes you stop and think. And we had a really good shoot with my very irreverent, naughty team.
I was
going to
say,
around.
Not the words. They look so elegant and well-behaved.
Do that? They are so not well-behaved.
Is that an illusion?
Absolutely.
The photographer has captured there. And lovely foiling you've got on there. And was there a sort of celebratory air, or were you a bit worried about, you know, let's make this an issue to remember. It's 80, you know, it's important to sort of mark the occasion. Or was it celebratory?
It was.
Largely?
I didn't used to celebrate. I always kind of used to push it aside and... I don't know what it was, my Catholic guilt upbringing maybe. But somebody changed that in my life and kind of shook me really hard and said, no, you can't do that anymore. So we all went out. I bought them all dinner and drinks and we marked the 80 in time. Yeah, it was a good night.
Another special issue here, lean and green. It's talking about kale there, but it's a lean, green, beautiful
looking
thing.
Yeah, it's our fresh and
well.
Light special. Sold out in 3 weeks. So people just love...
Is that a record or
I think
close to?
Close,
yeah.
I'd say so, except for maybe issue one.
Which
80 issues ago.
Which always a draw on people. 80 issues, amazing. Well, let me ask you a little bit more then about this idea of, I guess, where print sits in the sort of the overall empire and your overall approach. It's, you know, very multimedia, you've got all of these different disciplines and skills. Is print still within that sort of pantheon of interest? Is it front and centre for you? Do you sort of pride yourself on your print journalism, your print editor credentials above all else, or is it just one part of many? How do you sort of look at it?
No, I think it's really the backbone to my business, and it's really where my passion and my heart lies as well. I think when you're still passionate about what you do, 80 issues on, however many books on, that there's that real place for paper and print and the way it's crafted. Quite like Monocle, I think when you've got an exceptional print product, there's something different. We're not struggling. We're holding nicely in our market and our readers really appreciate what we do. I mean, we put so much care into every single photograph, into every single mood board and Pantone color chosen, everything that people obviously respond to that and they love it. Then they don't want to throw their magazine out. They want to keep it. They want to tag it. They want to take it to bed with them and flick through it, apparently, is the feedback on our social media.
Everything's welcome, all these different proclivities. It's always encouraging to hear about when an investment in a great product pays off. And I think you mentioned already that readers are loyal, they're very committed to it, and they're willing to spend money supporting brands that they feel are representing the things that they're interested in, the values that they have. And that, in a way, speaks a little bit to this idea of sort of quality of life, which we're talking about a lot on Monocle 24 and in the magazine, because we've got our inaugural conference, which is looking at some of these quality of life issues. I just wondered, going right back maybe to issue one even, and through your other work, quality of life is a bit of a nebulous concept, but does that inform what you do, a notion of quality of life, whether it's how you work, how you live, how you put your projects together? Is it an important thing to consider? How are we describing quality of life?
When you look at a print product, it has to describe a quality of life. And for me, I'm a big personal advocate of that. Go back to issue one. That's really fun, like kind of strange story, is that I just came back from New York. I'd been offered a job by Martha Stewart. Arrived back in Sydney. It's summer. You can swim until 9 o'clock at night. Everyone's outside. It's a great place to live. And luckily enough, I was really unsure about moving to New York. I was unsure in myself that I could be that creative with that quality of life, not being able to go for a swim after work and just do everything that Australia has to offer. So I was lucky enough that I was offered my own magazine. It felt such the right thing to do to stay. And that's why I haven't really been able to leave it as my base, Sydney, because for me, I can work as hard as you want me to. But if I don't have some sort of quality of life, I don't know that on the weekend I'm, you know, jumping on my stand-up paddleboard or I'm going to Bondi for a run with all the beautiful people. And, you know, if I don't have that kind of hook of quality of life, then I just can't sustain it. I can't sustain the workload and I really don't feel like I can sustain the creativity that I need.
In terms of that balance, I mean, there's that cliche about work-life balance, but, you know, you've obviously worked for big titles as a freelancer and sort of independent sector, doing your own sort of burgeoning empire, if you like. Do you think it is easy to adhere to those principles, getting that balance right? Is it something that you try and do with your colleagues and with employees as well? Is it an easy thing to do, or do you need to work at ensuring that balance is
right? No, I think you need to be really, really disciplined. You can so get sucked into working crazy hours. And people look at me really strangely, but my office is open from 8:30 till 5:30. 6 o'clock is the absolute limit. When you're there, we have a whole heap of fun and we laugh, and I'm probably the most noise-making, joke-making, disruptive person in the office. But There's also a level of work that people do all day. They're not on their Facebook page. They work really hard when they're there and then they leave at 5:30. I don't want to see them there at 7:30. How creative are you going to be tomorrow if you've worked till 9 o'clock? It doesn't work for me and it shouldn't work. I don't feel like it works for the rest of my team. So when we're there, we have a lot of fun, but it's pretty intense. And then I want to see everyone out the door. If I see anyone there past when I am,
You're not happy.
Well, I'm not happy because I don't want them to be there. I want them to be outside enjoying themselves. And that's how they come back into the office and be creative, is that they've seen something or they've done something or they feel inspired or they feel rested, even happy.
That sounds like a very good idea to me. I'm making some mental notes. Making some mental notes for myself.
He's going to love me, isn't
little,
he?
little meeting with the editor in chief later. Donna, just tell us what else is coming up. What other things have we got to look forward to? Obviously, lots more great magazines. Where is your travels going to be taking you? What other things should we be looking out for? Any exciting news?
Oh, I'd like to do some more TV, but some sort of different TV. I think the biggest challenge with food and TV is that most of the people getting commissioned are men. There's not many women in the TV food arena. And there's a lot of interest in sort of like the cooking reality show sort of thing where I cook and then someone has to try and replicate it and I judge them. And I'm so not that person. I don't want to judge anyone. I'd like to think that you go home and maybe cook something this weekend and you know, invite your friends over or just eat something tasty.
Sort of friendlier almost. Bit of a friendlier, collegiate approach to the sort of environment.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a tough one to get around. Just wanting to do beautiful food that's styled well and in a beautiful location that everyone, people just want to look at that, I think. You know, there's a bit of voyeurism on TV when you see beautiful property shows or travel shows, and I think it should be in food as well. I don't always think it needs to be a game show.
Do you think it's aspirational? I mean, you mentioned the idea of people actually going to then go and try and execute these things, have a go, you know, have some fun with it. Is that what you hope that the influence of the magazines and the shows that you do is? It is about engaging people and getting them to try something different? Or are you okay if it's a bit aspirational? If people, you know, this cliche again of, you know, food porn, do you mind if people are kind of ogling the pages of the magazines? Is everyone welcome, basically?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you've got to divide your content up into, okay, it's Wednesday night, am I going to inspire you to cook when you get home? That's a tough one. So really short, concise recipes might hook you in. But there's also has to be an element of voyeurism, whether it's online or in your magazine, that people do just ogle over it and get excited. They might never cook it. Some people do. But food's gone into that other direction of, as you say, food porn. It's definitely there.
There's room for everybody.
Yes, absolutely.
Lovely stuff. Donna Hay, thanks very much for coming to speak with us again here on Monocle 24.
Oh, thank you.
And that brings us to the end of this 138th edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Special thanks to both my guests today, Donna Hay, and to our own Richard Spencer Powell. Our producer was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Nathan Cooper was our studio manager. If you want to learn more about Monocle and Quality of Life, then be sure to watch our films from the inaugural Quality of Life conference coming soon at monocle.com and iTunes. And of course, save the date, our July-August Quality of Life special edition of Monocle magazine will soon be on its way. Any comments or queries about the show, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us again next Saturday. Until then, though, it's goodbye.